Do's and Don'ts of Co-Parenting. The word co-parenting can mean different things. Traditionally, it's been applied to divorced or separated parents who share custody. But it can also apply to grandparents who are helping raise their grandkids, or step-parents, or even the way that married couples share in the parenting strategies and responsibilities in their home. A new lab at the University of Maine focuses on research into parenting, exploring the dynamics of all kinds of co-parenting situations. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll explore this huge part of American family life. What are the guidelines for making any co-parenting situation the best possible for the kids? How can grandparents enrich a child's life without undermining mom or dad? What have you learned if you've been a co-parent? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Being a parent brings joys and challenges. Co-parenting, or having to share that role with someone else, makes things even more complicated. Today, we're going to talk about different ways to co-parent and how to deal with some of the tricky issues that can arise. Joining me in our studio, Daniel Pullman is Assistant Professor of Family Studies at the University of Maine. He heads the new Parenting Relationships Research Lab. Tim Robbins is Executive Director of Kids First Center in Scarborough. And Lisa Shemalecki is a family law attorney and guardian ad litem. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you in some sort of co-parenting arrangement? What do you find particularly challenging? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. I'll repeat that, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you. And Daniel, I want to start with you. Your parenting lab is fairly new, less than a year old, and unique as well. Tell us about the kind of research you're doing there.
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's the first real parenting focus that we have at the University of Maine. And really what we're looking at is anything related to parenting relationships. So how parents relate to their kids, how parents relate to each other, because this idea of relationships in parenting to me is probably the most important thing. And, you know, one of the things I think of for parents is how do we connect and build those relationships with the people that we care about? It's modeling for kids. It's helping parents kind of show children how to relate to others in the world. And so the research we're doing is really looking into that. And specifically, we're focusing a lot in co-parenting. So how parents kind of work together or don't to help manage and raise their children. So we're doing some qualitative work around looking at parents' perspectives around how the other parent influences them, what their experiences of that are like. We're also looking at some professionals and what they think about parenting and co-parenting and the types of programming that's available for those folks as well. And we're doing some projects around some solutions and ways that we can help parents to be able to communicate better and function as a team more effectively and be able to raise healthy and happy children.
And we're talking about co-parents. Who are you talking about?
We talk about in the academic literature, anybody who's working together with somebody else to raise a child. So this would certainly be biological parents that work together. It could be adoptive parents that have children. It could be gay or lesbian parents that have kids. It could be a parent and a grandparent who are functioning as a team to be able to kind of raise their children and help them. So really any group or team of people. Sometimes you even have three people. Two parents and a grandparent may be working together. So any combination of that would be a co-parent.
All right. Well, I want to turn to you, Tim. You're the executive director of Kids First. And I understand Kids First in has been around for a long time, since the 80s.
About 21 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you work primarily, and correct me if I'm wrong, with the children of divorce or separation, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's our target. That's kind of the gateway where people come to the center is through divorce or separation, primarily cases filed with the court. Court will refer parents to the Kids First Center, although we do have people coming on their own without court intervention, but primarily it's the gateway from a court referral to the Kids First Center.
And I'm wondering, as the research has grown and as Kids First has grown, has The advice changed, and the ways you work with parents changed since the 80s. Are there best practices now that maybe didn't exist back then?
Well, I guess I would say that the core thing that we're trying to get people to understand and parents to understand is it's the exposure to conflict that we're trying to teach folks in all kinds of different families. So the changes of the way the families are looking, how they're coming through the door, the divorce kind of model, people married, having children, divorcing. A lot more people are coming through the door that have never been married. And some have actually never really been together, and they're having children. And so it's not so much the advice that changes. It's the way families are built, what they look like. But ultimately, the message is the more conflict between the child's caregivers, whether it's a mom or a dad or two moms or two dads or a grandparent, it's that exposure to conflict is what creates bad outcomes for children. When people learn to cooperate, even people that don't like each other, and insulate the child from that conflict, the more likely a better outcome for the child.
All right, Lisa, I saw you out of the corner of my eye nodding.
Yes.
Tell me from your perspective how things have changed in your career.
So I would echo exactly what Tim has said. And I think as far as, so I've been practicing for about 11 years now. And a difference I see in some lawyers who have been practicing much longer than that is that I think there is a new focus on alternative dispute resolution in family law cases, meaning there's a bigger emphasis on getting two parties to a divorce or separation to really work together to try to resolve their legal matter, where before I think there was less of a focus on that, which meant more people were using the court system to have judges decide, you know, what the final schedule was going to be for their children, how decisions were going to be made for their children. And one thing that I emphasize to all of my clients is a decision that you can come to together is going to help your children and is going to be, both of you will have an easier time following it, being flexible around it if you create it yourselves, rather than going through a contested hearing where it's the job of both parties to throw as much mud as possible and then let a total stranger decide the future, your children's future, your family's future.
All right. I want to talk about one of the kinds of co-parents. And I learned doing the research this morning, Daniel, that the number of grandparents co-parenting is back on the rise. And it's really the graph is really interesting. I looked at a study by the Pew Research Center that it used to be about 20% of homes had a grandparent living in the home, and then it went way down, and now it's back up to about 20%. Are the reasons different than they were a couple generations ago?
I think that's interesting that you say grandparents living in the home. What I've seen and what we talked about in the research is that there's more grandparents actually raising children without parents involved because of different reasons for absence, whether it be mental health issues, drug and alcohol abuse, it could be military service. But there's a lot of reasons that grandparents are actually the primary caregivers, whereas they're not just living in the household with families, which is kind of the way things worked years ago, but more about this, they're taking over responsibility for the kids, which is incredibly stressful for grandparents, you know, and so that can be a really challenging thing. So they may be actually co-parenting from afar or co-parenting through other challenges and issues. Like I said, mental health and drug abuse are common.
Wow. Which of these in Maine and what you see, which is most common? What are you seeing? Is it the opioid epidemic? Is it military service?
I can't really speak for Maine because I haven't been practicing in Maine a lot. I'm kind of newer to this area. But I can say that, you know, I think with the opioid epidemic, that certainly raises some concern that when parents are addicted to a substance like that, it's really hard for them to parent. And somebody has to step up. You know, you wouldn't let your kids drive the car. So usually an adult will step up, and that would be a grandparent. So I think that would be probably a fair assessment. Tim, and you might have some feedback on that one as well?
Yeah, I mean, statistically, I'm not sure of the numbers, but certainly the opioid crisis does play a role in that. Not quite on topic, but when the state gets involved, they certainly look for kinship placements, and so grandparents will be a first line of defense if kids are in jeopardy with their own parents. Now, a lot of those parents are actually not the grandparents are not co-parenting per se, but actually, as Daniel says, they're actually parenting with no involvement. And so what's often difficult for the children is when those parents come back in, creates conflict. So again, it goes, for me, it always goes back to the what conflict are the children being exposed to. And it could be the reintroduction of a parent who's got themselves in a much better place where they can parent. Or it could be a reintroduction when they're not in a good place and I'm back. So there are all sorts of situations where grandparents, aunts, uncles, families are coming together to form a village to take care of children.
So, you know, part of this conversation makes my heart hurt for children who are dealing with families in such conflict. And I'm wondering what we know about what kids are resilient and end up doing okay and which kids don't.
I think that's a really interesting question. You know, kids are resilient. And in many cases, when parents don't parent well, kids can do okay. You know, it's not a death sentence. It certainly is going to increase their chances to do better. Kids tend to excel more when parents can figure this stuff out. So I think, yeah, I think this idea of co-parenting and kind of achieving a level of resilience is important. You know, in some cases, sometimes one parent is healthier than the other, and that can be a factor in terms of helping children to adapt and adjust. So I think those are pretty important.
Yeah. And I think that what we teach at the Kids First Center is that kids are resilient. They can work through their parents separating, living in different households, that they do adapt to that. What they can adapt to is their parents fighting in front of them, making them part of their agendas within their interpersonal dispute. That's what they don't adapt to. They don't, kids aren't resilient to that kind of thing, but they are resilient to, we have two houses now. Now, does that make them sad? Yeah, but they can get through that. What they can't get through is mom yelling at dad, dad yelling at mom, mom not talking to dad, complete silence of the between the two people that love them the most, not talking to one another. That's really hard for a kid to reconcile because they both say they love me, but they don't talk to each other. And so those are the places where we try to help parents learn what kids can cope with and what they can't cope with. And so that's really the thrust of our education programs is to give parents those kind of tools, which is no rule book or tool book that comes with that you get when you decide, one, to be a parent, or two, decide not to be a parent with somebody else. There's no rule book that comes with that.
Yeah, there's no rule book for any of it. Lisa, you know, I know that custody is a big issue that comes up. What are some of the other issues that come up when parents are not regarding kids, when parents are not together anymore?
Sure. So custody is a funny word that our laws actually don't use the word custody.
Really?
So, yeah, we don't. And when people come in to see me and talk about custody, I often don't know what they're referring to. Is it where the child is sleeping at night? How many nights they're sleeping in one home as opposed to the other? Or are you talking about how decisions are going to be made? Who has authority over a child? So the terms that we use are sort of residence and contact. That's sort of one package. Where is a child literally going to be living in the course of a week or 2 weeks? How much time will they spend in one parent's home as opposed to the other? So that we're talking about residence. And then The other part of that is rights and responsibilities. And when we use that term, we're talking about how decisions are made about children, anything regarding a child's well-being. And the law in Maine actually presumes, I should say, that two parents who are separating have shared rights and responsibilities, meaning they both have equal say and input into any decision regarding a child's welfare. And so that's everything from religion to whether or not when your daughter gets her first set of earrings is really the decision of both parents. And that requires a lot of communication. Sometimes two people getting separated with children have to learn to communicate more than they ever have, even in the course of their relationship. And that's a hard wake-up call.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. You gave some good examples, one of them when a daughter might get her first earrings. Or I imagine there are all sorts of issues in which two people, whether or not they're a couple who's been separated or different generations, feel really differently about really day-to-day stuff.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's interesting that, you know, we're talking about a number of different disciplines here. You're talking about research and the legal system and then the clinical system, which really brings into this conversation of how we see things differently. You know, like a clinician, for example, is going to be very involved in the intimacy that exists between the co-parents and a child. And so they would be dealing with different things, whereas the legal system is interested in other pieces of in terms of the, you know, legal expectations around divorce. And then research is really interested in kind of how does this have an impact and where are the impacts and things like that. And so these multiple kind of differences are really important in terms of understanding that power and how, you know, how I guess co-parents function from a day-to-day perspective to an overall perspective. You know, development is a trajectory over time. And so, you know, there's a lot of different factors that go into this. I think that screams to the complexity of co-parenting and parenting in general, that there's a lot of moving parts here that make it difficult, you know, and for parents to figure out what happens for their kids, you know, and find ways to agree on complex issues and simple ones. You know, sometimes it's as simple as what sport do they participate in?
Yeah, and I can imagine every single one can be fraught in some way.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like to join the conversation, we're talking about co-parenting, but we're really talking about parenting. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Coveside Healthcare Coverage Options, whose founder, Caroline Irwin, specializes in helping Mainers transition into Medicare. CovesideLLC.com. And Now You're Cooking, a cookware store offering kitchen tools, bakeware, and fine wine on historic Front Street in downtown Bath, open 7 days a week.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
I love Maine. Maine's a great place. I was born in Maine. I was born in Waterville, Maine. Grew up here in a handful of spots in the state. And I left, like many Mainers do. I left the state, traveled out to Wyoming, to Jackson Hole, out to the middle of the ocean, to the tropics, and back. And I found nowhere to be like Maine. Maine's a special place. The people here are amazing. Life here runs at its own pace. It's unique. It's unlike anywhere else I've found in my travels. My name's Seamus. I live in Falmouth these days, but I lived all over the state. I love Maine, and this is my Maine.
This Is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to mainepublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Maine Public Radio isn't the only trusted source for journalism available to you from Maine Public. There's also Maine Public Television. Each evening between 5 and 6, there's now a full hour of BBC News. Following that at 6, there's the PBS NewsHour, which is also available at 7 each evening. The Maine Public Television early evening news block schedule is at mainepublic.org. Click on television to see the schedule, or click on the evening news banner link on the homepage for more information.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, how different people approach co-parenting, sharing the responsibilities and duties of being a parent. My guests are Tim Robbins, who is executive director of Kids First Center in Scarborough. Lisa Shemalecki is a family law attorney and guardian ad litem. And Daniel Pullman is an assistant professor of family studies at the University of Maine, where he leads the Parenting Relationships Research Lab. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. You know, earlier in the program, Daniel, I asked Tim and Lisa how their work has changed, but I didn't ask you, how has research changed about parenting and co-parenting over the last 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, the idea of co-parenting is fairly new in research, quite honestly. It came into the landscape through the court system, actually, where when the advent of no-fault divorce became universal across the United States, there became this issue around parents children living between parents. And so co-parenting became a legal problem and a concern. And then researchers jumped on board probably in the late 90s, you know, in that time frame. And so it's a fairly newer area of research. We know a lot about co-parenting, but there's a lot we don't know. Like, we know that it has substantial impacts on children. We know that it has substantial impacts on parental well-being across the board. And so we can see that those kind of influences exist. We are still thinking about, in terms of where research is going, is what do we do about it? And so finding solutions and ways to help and help co-parents to adjust to those problems. So it's a kind of a complex conversation about how does the, you know, kind of the programs that Kids First is offering, how have they shifted over the years? We're still learning how they should be shifting in the current time point. So I think given that newness of the research, that kind of helps us to think about, we don't really know yet and we're still learning.
We'll go to Maggie, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Maggie. Go ahead.
Hi. So I went through a divorce about a year ago, and when my parents had gotten divorced in the 80s, you know, I was the product of being stuck in the middle. So when I got divorced, all I knew was that's not what the experience I wanted my child to have. So my former husband and I did the Kids First program, and it was such an eye-opening experience for us to truly have the tools to be able to put our child at the center. You know, he wasn't asking for us to get divorced, and we really wanted to make sure he wouldn't be, you know, an extra victim in all of this. So we learned the most amazing tools, that we still do family dinner night together, we're at his games together, and we've had a lot of people say to us, you know, you've really inspired us to even be better parents. And I think Kids First is actually something people should take before they have children, because I think there's so many amazing things that you can learn, whether you're married or divorced, to just make you better co-parents in general.
Oh, Maggie, thanks for your call. Well, we have you on the line. Is there any one piece of advice that you go back to again and again you'd like to share?
Really having that half an hour check-in time a week to sit down and talk about your kids. And Kids First says, you know, always start with the celebration. You know, share one thing that really went well for your family that week, your child that week, set it off on a good point, and then you can go into, you know, the bigger issues that you might have to talk about. And if you feel your personal tensions rising, like have a safe word almost, that reminds both of you to bring it back and talk about just what's in the best interest of your child.
Thanks for calling, Maggie.
You know, thank you, Maggie, for the kind comments about the Kids First Center. We hear that comment more often than you would think. People wanting the information sooner in the process, and sometimes before they even think about divorce or separation. The principles that we teach at the Kids First Center are universal. They're not just for people that are divorcing and separating. That's our clientele. But if we could get that message out about communicating, how one can effectively communicate, even with someone that you're not particularly fond of right now, we might be able to get more people understanding what it takes to parent a child when you're not together. I mean, it's not impossible to do. It's actually possible to do with someone that you're not particularly fond of right now. That's what we really try to impress in our classes, that there's ways of doing this, and it's not as hard as one would think, as long as you can put some of the history behind and just look forward to the parenting experience, because ultimately we want the parenting experience to be good for both parents as well as the child.
Daniel?
And I also think it's important to recognize, Maggie, that's great that that's been a positive experience, but there's a lot of different ways to do this. Some parents are able to have dinners and hang out and spend time together. Some co-parents can't, but they can function as business partners where they can do the tasks of raising children, they can do the basic communication, and the kids live happy and healthy lives. So there's a lot of variations to co-parenting, and there's no real right way. There's the way that works best for the kids.
We'll go to Susan, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a psychologist and have worked with many kids and parents who've gone to Kids First, which is a tremendous resource for people, no question. What I haven't heard anybody say is that reinforcing that co-parenting isn't just what happens between the parents about the child. It also involves involving other children in children's lives. For example, when parents hold parental rights and responsibilities, it's critical that pediatricians, the therapist, the psychologist, the school, the sports coach know that informing the other parent, keeping the other parent in the loop when the child is brought in to the pediatricians, for example, making sure that that other parent is contacted. That's a way in which co-parenting is it's validated to it's not just up to Kids First to validate the importance or the attorneys to validate the importance of good co-parenting, but hearing it from the pediatrician that we also need to talk to your child's dad, we also need to talk to your child's mom, or for the therapist, when one parent brings the child right away, that they be clear that if parents hold joint rights and responsibilities, it is really very important to make sure that that other parent is involved, even if the parent who has brought the child is saying, oh, no, you don't want to talk to him, or no, you don't need to talk to her. If they hold parental rights and responsibilities, it's a critical way in which co-parenting is validated.
Lisa.
Susan, thank you so much. It's great to hear that, because as an attorney, I can say one of the hardest things that can happen in a case is when children, one parent brings a child to see a therapist without the other parent's knowledge, and the children are, the therapist is seeing those children for a long period of time with no interaction with the other parent. And so I find that the best therapists do reach out to both parents in the beginning, and some even require that parents who have shared rights and responsibilities do alternate taking the children to therapy. This way they each have equal opportunity to talk with the therapist and get information, share input. But the only other thing I wanted to add to that is, while I completely appreciate that the more that pediatricians and therapists and teachers and principals need to understand that there are sometimes two households and both need to be kept informed, I also think it's every co-parent's responsibility to keep the other parent informed. And a lot of times, both as a lawyer and as a facilitator at Kids First, I'll hear parents say, well, he or she has the same access to the portal as I do, that, you know, or he or she can sign in to, you know, the pediatrician's website and see the same things that I do. And I think what's important for children and is that the two parents are also talking about these things, and that the two parents get in the habit of sharing that information. Even if both have equal access to it, it cannot hurt to share copies of things, take a photo of the soccer schedule and send it to your co-parent. even if that co-parent can get it him or herself. It's the act of actually sharing information. Our children pick up on that. They see and know when their two parents are sharing. And to me, that sends them a message. Look how much we love you. We both love you so much. We're talking about you, even though we no longer live together, even though we're no longer under one household. And I think that's such an important message to send to our kids.
Tim.
Yeah, and totally agree. The other relationship that we really haven't really spent much time on is the parent-child relationship and how a parent can derail a co-parenting relationship just the way they interact with their own child. For instance, we hear this all the time. Our kids come to us and say, "Oh, mommy, mommy, mommy! I really wanna fill in the blank. I wanna play soccer." Well, that's okay with me, but you're gonna have to ask your dad. You know, that's just not the way. That's not the message that you really want to give your child. What we say at Kids First is you respond to your child something like, "Hey, that's great." But that's a decision that mom and dad need to make. We'll get back to you. It's always okay to say, "I'm going to get back to you," and let the child know that it's a parental decision, and it's not setting up this contest where one of the parents looks like a bad guy. So those are the kind of things that the practical things that we try to impart on parents that can make the co-parenting experience so much easier. It's just the fact of that conversation about soccer as opposed to it being made unilaterally makes a huge difference in how the parents will work with each other the next time around.
Susan, thanks for your call. I want to go to an email here from Lucy. What are your thoughts regarding how much parents should communicate with their children honestly about what's going on when they're co-parenting? I can see both sides. You want to be honest, but also keep them safe and happy. For example, if your child is going to spend time with the other parent but you don't approve, how should you have that conversation?
I'm going to jump into that because I think, you know, being cautious of too much information, you know, it's one thing to lie to your children and tell them false information. It's another thing to say, "Well, you know what, that's between your mom and dad and I," you know, or your dad and I or whoever. And so I think that there's a pretty important role for parents to shield children from those discussions because it's really not their business. You know, like Tim was using the example of, you know, it's our decision whether or not you play soccer. And that's really the most important thing to do that. And so, you know, one of the things that catches a lot of co-parents is even when kids come back from the other parent's house and they'll say, "Oh, dad did this or mom did this," you know, parents buy into that and start feeding that beast. And that just creates more animosity and frustration and anger. And it's like, you know, In most cases, it's if your kid comes and says something to you about what happens in the other parent's house, "Oh, that's great. Sounds like fun. Oh, you might want to talk to your dad about that," you know, depending on whether it's positive or negative, and staying out of that stuff. If kids ask, you know, "What are you and dad going to do about it?" You know, that's for your dad and I to talk about or something like that. You know, really kind of keeping those conversations between the co-parenting unit and keeping the kids out of that process.
We'll go to Gina, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Gina. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm co-parenting my granddaughter. My son is out of the loop, and I'm working with my granddaughter's mother. And the biggest problem we're having is communication. She's fairly young, and I will sometimes get notice 5 minutes before she'd like to drop her off, or find out that she, you know, she doesn't call, and I have her for days longer than I expected. And I'm wondering how we can make that work. I mean, simply put, there's no way I can get her into a mediation sort of meeting. It's just not going to happen. So the real question is, what can I do to make it easier for her to communicate, or to make it, to let her know how important it is to communicate with me?
I think one of the key parts of co-parenting, especially in your situation where you're working with a younger parent, is to me boundaries. You know, setting those expectations and boundaries and saying that you're part of this process, but, you know, not tolerating that 5 minutes before. I think those are really stressful things for the kids too, because they're bouncing around. And so I think, setting good boundaries, setting clear expectations of what you can and can't do are really important in that process. That would be one of my first recommendations, I think.
in a little bit of a harder situation than, say, a divorce situation, because in divorce, parental separation, there actually are laws that help define what the communication needs to look like, how parents are to behave. But in that, your situation, unfortunately, unless there's some kind of court intervention, there is no framework in order to force the same expectations that you would if you were divorcing this person. So I think Daniel's absolutely right that sitting down and trying to create as clear of boundaries as you possibly can, knowing that it may work or it may not, but you continue, as we tell people at the Kids First Center, you can only control your side of things. You can't control anybody else. So you need to just continue doing what you think works with this, with your co-parent, and understand that there are limits of how much you can control in that. And at some point, when all parents or grandparents finally decide that I've done my best, but I've reached a limit, you can't control anymore.
We do need to take another quick break. We're talking about co-parenting on Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com. And Coastal Transitions of Maine, a locally owned company offering personalized help with senior living options. Learn more at coastaltransitionsofmaine.com.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 17, 1811, David Dunn, the 18th governor of Maine, was born in Cornish, Maine. He studied law, was admitted to the bar in 1833, and established a legal practice in Poland Corner. Dunn entered politics in 1840, serving as a member of the Maine House of Representatives. On January 1, 1844, Acting Governor Edward Kavanaugh resigned from office, and Dunn, who was Speaker of the House at the time, assumed the duties of the governorship.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park. Happy birthday, Maine.
A New England town has decided to reinstate a school mascot that critics say is racist and offensive to Native Americans.
Naming a team a skin color in 2020 is just ridiculous, really.
On Next, from the New England News Collaborative, how Killingly, Connecticut ditched the mascot and then brought it back. Plus, tracing the rise of two Massachusetts schools to college football. Please join us.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the challenges of co-parenting. Joining me, Lisa Shemalecki, a family law attorney. Daniel Pullman is with UMaine's Parenting Relationships Research Lab. And Tim Robbins is with Kids First. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. One thing we really haven't talked about yet is step-parents. And Daniel, one thing I read this morning is that it usually takes 2 to 5 years when a step-parent comes into the mix for everything to sort of even out and find some equilibrium. Do you agree with that?
Actually, it takes longer. That is one of the most complicated additions to a family that happens in divorce and separation. When a parent gains a new partner, that totally makes the system more convoluted and difficult. All kinds of challenges come in. And in many cases, that's where the co-parenting relationship breaks down between the biological parents, is that another parent has opinions and perspectives and ideas. And that gets to be really challenging. And so it can take a long time for them to the family is in itself to function more as a collective unit. That's also going to depend on age of the child, you know, other developmental issues or challenges. Older kids take a lot longer. Younger kids adapt a little bit faster. So 7 years is a range. It can be a little shorter. It can be a little longer.
Wow. Lisa.
Yeah, I would say that I would agree with all of that. I think both at Kids First and in my practice, we often see a lot of times two people do very well after separating, co-parenting together. And when repartnering is often the first time they start to experience problems. And it's a really tricky situation to figure out. How much authority does the step-parent have? And I think it's sort of common but unfortunate that sometimes step-parents do overstep their boundaries. They want things a certain way. If they're a better communicator than their partner, they might start communicating with the other parent instead of the biological parent. And that really can present a lot of problems. So Kid First, actually, and I'll let Tim talk about it, but offers a class very specific to that for parents and their new partners. I don't know, Tim, do you want to talk about
no,
that?
No, I was going to actually say the same thing, that it is such an issue that that families need to navigate, that we have a class dedicated to new partners and trying to teach different strategies there of how new partners can come in without causing additional conflict to the existing system.
Tim, Kids First is in Scarborough, but obviously we have listeners all over the state of Maine. Are there other places that you offer classes? And I want to ask also if UMaine does as well.
Yeah, we certainly do. We have live classes in Biddeford, Topsom, Farmington. We hope to be going, and we will be going to an online product within the next few months, so that the entire state will have access to basically we have a 4-hour introductory class, and that class is the springboard to all the other classes. And
hoping to have that online soon.
Yeah,
that's great.
Hoping to have that.
And what
up
about
and running.
Daniel at UMaine? Are there going to be classes and things like that, or do they already exist?
UMaine doesn't have any. There is a class in Bangor called For Kids' Sake that does some of the similar types of things. And then there's a class, I believe it's R2 Homes in Augusta, that they offer some programming as well. You know, one of the biggest challenges in Maine is the rural nature of the state and accessing, you know, getting access to parents that travel long ways, and Prescott and beyond that is one of the things that being online is a really important piece. And as Kids First does that, that's going to really help open access to the parents that otherwise would have to travel hours to some of the programming. Even as far as Bangor, they'd still have to travel several hours to a program.
We'll go to Suzanne calling from Portland. Hi, Suzanne. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a clinician, and Kids First helped me establish my private practice, I think, over 20 years ago by being my bread and butter. So I've been working with divorcing families for that long. And you know, when listening, there's one issue with co-parenting that hasn't been mentioned, and that has to do with domestic violence or severe abuse when there's trauma involved. And it's, in those cases, not a good idea for the parents to co-parent. They usually cannot be in the same room. Clinically, it's bad practice, you know, or not done, to have a victim in the same room with the abuser. And so this really interferes with co-parenting, and you have to set up an entirely different system.
Sure, I can understand that, Suzanne. Thanks so much for your call. Lisa?
Yeah, Suzanne, hi. You are absolutely right that when there are incidents of domestic violence in two people's past or future, co-parenting is not possible and is oftentimes not the best practice really ever, unless there's been some serious repair since that trauma. And so, unfortunately, co-parenting doesn't work. And that is where the sort of legal structure of sole parental rights and responsibilities comes into play. Oftentimes, offenders of domestic violence are denied the rights and responsibilities to their children that other parents do get for
all
that
right.
reason.
Thank you, Suzanne, for the call. We're going to move to Lynn, who's calling from the Mid-Coast. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi. I work in a school system, and I wonder what advice the panel would have for schools in how to handle situations where the parents do not agree on a decision, potentially as simple as whether or not that child can be on the soccer team.
Oh, Lynn, you've had our guests, our experts all raise their eyebrows. This is something you all have encountered.
I just kind of first broadly say that I think one of the challenges in co-parenting is getting all professionals to understand how to work with these complex situations. And educators are certainly one of the big ones, but speech pathologists, therapists, physical therapists, anybody who works with children that has an engaging time with parents has to figure out this dilemma. And so I think, especially with schools where there's some very concrete and regular decisions that parents have to come together and think about, it's really challenging. I think if we could offer more training to teachers to help them to learn how to do this, that would be really valuable. As far as how, what types of things, there's lots of different strategies. You know, a lot of listening, a lot of supportive coaching, a lot of kind of giving, empowering parents to try to make decisions together are some of the first kind of ideas that I would come up with. I'll hand it off to the others to say.
Yeah, I'll jump in. We hear this kind of comment quite a bit. First piece of advice is don't get sucked into the rabbit hole of getting involved in parental disputes, because a lot of these parents that are in dispute want to bring in all sorts of other professionals within to get them kind of on your side. Now, if you're taking a strictly legalistic view of it, if parents have shared parental rights and they don't agree, then it doesn't happen. It's as simple as that. So it's really, I think a lot of times it's what's the buy-in for both parents? Are they both involved? Is there something else going on that has nothing to do with the child? And so those are always the things that I guess I'd be looking at, that because a child doesn't have to play soccer. And if the parents don't agree, then theoretically under shared parental rights, it wouldn't happen.
All right. Thanks, Lynn. I want to go to another email because we're short on time and this is related. This is from Asia. My kids live in South Berwick. I've been divorced for 3 years. Our family therapist says our relationship is more of a parallel parenting relationship than co-parenting relationship. One thing I struggle with is my children's education. My four kids have been homeschooled since they were in kindergarten. My co-parent homeschools them. I've been trying to get them enrolled in public school for 3 years. I found that the courts don't know how to approach this. We have joint custody. However, she has the final decision for education. My co-parenting partner is unqualified to teach. My kids are woefully behind in their lessons. I wondered if your panel has seen any situations like this and if there are resources I can reach out to for helping get my kids into public school.
I, as an attorney, I've seen lots of situations like that, whether it's about education. I've seen this exact problem at least a few times in my career where one parent is homeschooling and the other parent wants their child in a public school system. There's more information that of course, I would need to know about, you know, why one parent was allocated final say in education. So legally, your co-parent does have the authority to make that decision. However, it doesn't mean that it has to be that way forever. I guess what I would encourage you to do is maybe seek out mediation encourage your co-parent to attend a kid's first class. Try to do something outside of the courthouse that where both of you can reach a compromise on this issue. It might not mean that either of you get exactly what you want, but that trying to find a compromise so that, you can have an education plan for your children that you both support.
All right. Well, there are so many more questions coming in, and I apologize to all of you we haven't been able to get to. I would recommend that you reach out to some of the resources, including our guest resources that will be on our Facebook page and web page later this afternoon. Thank you so much to all of our guests here today. The voice you just heard, Lisa Shemalecki, a family law attorney and guardian ad litem. Daniel Pullman heads University of Maine's Parenting Relationships Research Lab, and Tim Robbins is Executive Director of Kids First. Lucy Suchek ran the board today, and Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. An important note, next week, starting Tuesday, Maine Public Radio will be broadcasting special coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. You'll still be able to hear Maine Calling live by going to our website. We are going to be streaming all of our regular programming, including Maine Calling, at our regular time. Go to mainepublic.org if you'd like to hear Maine Calling all of next week and as long as the Senate trial continues. Until then, I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.